Welcome to Thoughts on Record, official podcast of the Ottawa Institute of Cognitive Behavioral Therapy. Each episode, we explore topics of interest to clinicians and mental health consumers from a cognitive behavioral perspective. I'm your host, Dr. Pete Kelly.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. Hope Arnold, LCSW, and MA is a supervisor and trainer in Radically Open DBT, or RODBT. She began her RODBT training with Dr. Tom Lynch, developer of RODBT, in 2016. Hope is co-creator of the RODBT app for electronic diary cards and skills. In her clinical work, Hope is the founder of RODBT Denver in Denver, Colorado, a center dedicated to evidence-based care and treating disorders of overcontrol. She specializes in personality disorders, eating disorders, autism spectrum disorders, and treatment resistance disorders. Prior to opening RODBT Denver, Hope was in private practice at the DBT Center of Houston and was the RODBT lead clinician. She led a team of six clinicians intensively trained in RODBT and supervised the team members' skill development. Hope completed her intensive training in DBT and prolonged exposure therapy through behavioral tech. Hope is also trained in Jungian therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, and cognitive processing therapy. Hope graduated from Loyola University in New Orleans with a BBA in marketing. She worked for two of the largest private financial and consulting firms in the world before transitioning to being a clinician. She has a master's degree in social work from the University of Houston and psychology from Saybrook University with a concentration in Jungian studies. Hope has presented at the local, national, and international level on topics related to DBT, RODBT, and Jungian theory. All right, Hope Arnold, welcome to Thoughts on Record. How are you doing today?
Great. Thanks, Pete, for having me today.
You are very welcome. Hope, I've been really excited for this podcast for quite a while. Radically Open DBT, or RODBT, as we'll probably end up calling it quite a bit today, is a therapeutic framework that has only come onto my radar recently, but I'm absolutely fascinated about the promise of this approach. While clients who present with emotion dysregulation or under control of emotions can present some, you know, very, very specific challenges and opportunities within the therapeutic setting, therapeutic work with clients who are over controlled as far as emotions go can really present its own set of unique challenges. And I know personally, I need to look no further than my work with military personnel and police officers for many, many clinical examples of this. I guess as we spoke about via email when we were setting up the podcast, many clients with over control are often, as I was saying, like hiding in plain sight. And despite significant internal suffering, it's not as obvious to us as clinicians that this is going on. So all this to say, I'm really curious to learn about the promise of RODBT for these clients. And I really want to thank you again for being here.
Great. Well, I'm thrilled to talk about it because I definitely think this is a developing area and a wonderful area for clinicians to maybe get interested in. And they may even see it more often than they think, for sure. Yeah.
Absolutely. So I guess I just want to start with the basics. Can we talk about what Radically Open DBT is? And I'd also like to know how you became interested in this particular therapeutic modality.
Sure. I'll start with how I became interested. So I was originally trained in traditional DBT, and I started to notice this sort of pattern of clients that weren't getting better with traditional DBT. And I was working with a number of people that also were noticing this. And my former boss down in Houston, Karen Hall, and I were, she'd gone to this RODBT training, and she goes, "Hope, these are the clients that you are, you know, seeing. And these are the clients that are not really getting better with traditional DBT." So I started to look into it, and I started to notice that the emotion regulation wasn't the problem. It was that the clients were overly regulated and inhibiting their facial expressions and not having any friends and lonely and sad. And while on the outside they look sort of fine, but on the inside they were pretty ill and suicidal. And we started to go, okay, well, we have to change our perspective and understand these clients a little better. So then RODBT training happened, and now I'm a supervisor with them, and I love it. I think it's been life-changing, not only for my clients, but also for me as well.
Oh, that's amazing. So What is RODBT? What would be maybe some of the core features, or how perhaps would it differ from traditional DBT that some of the listeners may be familiar with?
Yeah, so I think the best way to think about RODBT is that we're working on a problem of over-control. So someone that has actually too much impulse control, and there are four factors that really make up over control. And so the we look at it in terms of a bio temperament. And so a bio temperament is something that is genetically based. It's not something that changes over time. You're born either over-controlled or under-controlled. And traditional DBT is designed for under-controlled people. So people that are struggling with impulse control and struggling with emotion regulation. And RODBT is designed for people that have too much of a good thing, so to speak, even though actually it's really hurting them. And when I think about biotemperament, we're really talking about the biological basis of emotion. So how we perceive the world and how we regulate our emotions. So over control is made up of four particular things. So low reward sensitivity, meaning that, you know, an over control client might not get very excited about something. They're kind of like, oh, whatever. And then a high threat sensitivity. So they're seeing metaphorically thorns everywhere and not really seeing flowers. And they're really high detail focused, meaning that, you know, they pick up on errors everywhere, especially in themselves. And that can be actually a really hard way to live because they're just sort of like seeing the world as, you know, this is a problem, this is a problem, this is a problem, this is a problem. And with that detail focus. And then they have the ability to inhibit everything. So they're not showing anything on the outside, even if they're suffering really greatly on the inside. And if you think about something like anorexia, which is a high inhibitory control diagnosis, then you can understand like that's kind of what we mean, the ability to stop an impulse. So in that case, the ability to stop eating and actually starve yourself to death, it takes a giant amount of impulse control to actually do that. Yeah. So when these four factors are really extreme, an over-controlled person will respond more rigidly, less flexibly to an unpredictable environment, and they'll perceive threats everywhere, even if there's no danger. And so they're less likely to take in new information, and they're less likely to be able to adapt to changing circumstances or environments. And so it actually interferes with learning. It's because they have this really giant worldview that everything is kind of scary. And so they may look more uptight and feel more uptight than the average person because they're not really changing who they are if they go to a work or a party or home life, like most of us have flexible responding. And so they're really struggling to make those adaptations.
So understanding that over control is biologically based, as you were saying, are there certain developmental conditions or conditions within family of origin that would nudge along that temperament or facilitate the expression of that temperament? I'm thinking of a child maybe that has to navigate chaotic circumstances of some kind. They may choose to sort of make themselves the calm in the storm internally, despite everything that might be going on around them or something like that.
Yeah, so we're actually not really sure that the environment is the predictive factor. We're really thinking the biology is the predictive factor and then how the biology responds to the environment. So an over-controlled person may have two parents that are very chaotic and then still become over-controlled. Or an over-controlled client may have two very over-controlled clients and still have this high over-control nurturing that shapes them up. But what we think that's going on in their brain is that they're getting these messages from their environment and then responding to the message. And they are then learning to further inhibit, further mask, further not show their emotions. And that actually then shapes up the over control even higher. And we can start to see this as early as ages 3 and 4, this biology, these markers starting to come out. And so we know that it's happening very, very young. And then they are responding to their environment. A sort of interesting story about how that might look is, you know, if a client or if a very over-controlled child is sitting in a classroom, and they maybe have a under-controlled child sitting next to them. And this under-controlled child gets yelled at by a teacher, then saying, you know, be quiet, stop getting out of your seat, stop moving around. The over-controlled child actually then learns that they shouldn't get up, they shouldn't talk, they shouldn't move. And so it's not always just the parent shaping their world. It's actually them perceiving even somebody else's direction and then applying it to themselves because they're so threat sensitive just in their biology. I hope that helps.
Absolutely. So is maybe one of the paradoxes here is that despite being exquisitely sensitive to the environment, that may not shine through in the way that the person presents interpersonally. They may come across with perhaps having like a flat affect or being overly regulated despite feeling things intensely on the inside. Is that one way of thinking about the internal experience of these folks?
Sure. Yeah. They could have extremely strong emotions on the inside and not really be showing it on the outside. So if we take that example of that young child sitting in class and that young child is feeling very, very threatened by that interaction and they just can't really relax. So they might be always on edge and looking to be perfect or the perfect student and shaping things up because they don't want to get in trouble because of that natural biology to look at a situation and not think that it was directly applicable to them because they weren't really doing anything quote unquote wrong in that situation. Yeah.
What do you think about the role of perfectionism in this particular presentation? Is it a core feature? Is it something that can happen in anybody, but it tends to show up maybe preferentially in folks with over control? How do you see perfectionism blending into the story here?
Yeah, there's this kind of saying, you know, over control people are perfectionists. They don't need to do hard to work harder or do better. They actually need to learn to relax. So what a perfectionist is doing is trying to be perfect in every situation. And so maladaptive perfectionism is this problem of, you know, perseverating or keep doing something, even if it's not really working for you, it's hurting you. And so when they continue to be perfect. And actually what they're doing is getting more depressed or anxious or something like that. They're actually not able to see that they need to alter their behavior. And so then the perfectionism becomes really maladaptive and shaped up and they can't turn it off. And so we are really working with a lot of perfectionists and they're suffering greatly, although quietly, very quietly. Yeah.
Oh, I'm resonating with so much that you're saying clinically and personally, like you were reflecting at the beginning.
Interesting what you said, if you're resonating with it personally, because at least some of the research is showing, Dr. Lynch and others are taking, you know, they take surveys of people that come to training and we're starting to find out that, you know, therapists, psychologists, social workers, things like that tend to lean over control, as you might imagine, because it takes a lot of ability to delay gratification to get through things like grad school. And so, you know, and then there's like this giant inhibitory component to maybe facial expressions that sometimes comes along with therapy and sitting quietly with the client. Although we're trying to break some of those molds and have fun and play around in a lot of the therapy, which is different, I think, than most therapies. Mm-hmm.
You know what I find really interesting is I wear a Garmin device that gives me feedback about my stress level through heart rate variability. And I think I've got a pretty good poker face as far as therapy goes. Like, you know, you can hear really anything and my facial expression will just only subtly modulate itself, you know, just to let the client know that I've, you know, heard the information and whatnot. And I'll look at my watch after a session and my stress level can be like, is typically through the roof.
Yes.
You know, like
yes.
It's like 80 to 100 out of 100, speaking to that internal physiological reactivity, but outwardly, there's really nothing that's translating to that degree.
Yeah. So, you know, this topic is so incredibly important when we talk to therapists about how they present and how they show up in a session with a client, because a lot of times what has been trained up in a therapist is to not show expression. And actually what we're teaching our RO therapists is to have fun, relax, turn on your own safety system, express, you know, treat this as a more friendly relationship than a maybe hierarchical one, and really make sure that the client is relating to you because they need to learn how to deactivate their threat systems and turn on their social safety systems so they can actually express themselves. Because when we know that when their threat systems are on, it's actually harder for them to communicate and to really get anywhere in therapy. So a lot of times we're doing things like chilling out, leaning back, moving our face, talking to them, taking sips of water, starting to be much more conversational, which is really fun, actually. And I actually enjoy doing the therapy a lot as well, because then I come out of it and I feel better as well.
Mm-hmm. I know Zoom was a big eye opener for me. Of course, you can see yourself on Zoom. And I, you know, I, for the most part, keep that off. But at the beginning, when I was on it all the time, I was noticing how different my affect was coming across on camera versus my internal experience. And it, I have learned, I think, to sort of, you know, get a little bit more of my internal experience out into the interaction, knowing how maybe flat and regulated I was coming across previously, almost like looking mad or angry, although that was that was not my internal experience at all.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, this goes to this giant idea and the basis of the therapy too, is looking at a client's social signaling and how it's actually preventing them from joining their social community or their spouse or their partner, or their friends, or whoever they want to interact with. We're actually teaching them to take a look at it, because a lot of times nobody's really ever given us feedback on, like, hey, you know, Pete, I noticed that you have this sort of flat face or something like that when you do X, Y, or Z. And so we'll talk to a client like that, and we'll be like, hey, have you ever noticed that? Obviously you have good insight, so you maybe noticed that it's happening. And sometimes our clients are like, oh my gosh, I had no idea that I was doing that. And so then we talk to them about, okay, well, what is it that you're wanting to signal to another person? Do you need to move your face more? Do you need to talk with your hands? Do you need to get closer or farther away from someone, or modulate or regulate your voice differently? And then clients start to go, oh my gosh, this is really cool, because then they start to see their social interactions change and they feel closer to people. And when we have, you know, quote unquote, our people, then what ends up happening is we feel better. And so then they actually get better clinically as well, because they're now building their communities in such a strong, vivid way, which is wonderful to see. They have friends, they have good relationships, they have intimacy, because we need people.
I want to ask you a little bit more about the flexibility or perseveration piece. And I also want to come back to the RODBT as well. But before we lose this thread, I want to grab onto it for a second. Do we know why clients with overcontrol might make perseverative errors around sticking with a strategy that is only making things worse over time? And I guess the idea here is being preferentially attuned to one kind of threat in the environment while not monitoring accurately the threat internally of increased depression, anxiety, distress. So kind of decompensating in one area, continuing to act in the same way to mitigate an external threat. It doesn't make sense. And yet we all do it to some extent, but I'm imagining clients with overcontrol, again, it's a real problem.
Yeah. You know, maybe I'll answer this in terms of like a general topic, I think, because otherwise it's kind of hard to talk about it. So in RODBT, we're trying to build good mental health for an overcontrolled person. And that looks like three things. So receptivity and openness. So if you say to me some feedback and I immediately block it, which is maybe what an overcontrolled person does because they see things as so threatening, they aren't able to then adaptively respond or change. And so they actually are very closed-minded a lot because of that threat sensitivity. And so think about this too. If you're a perfectionist, you want to be good at something the first time that you try it. And so
what are you talking about?
We perfectionists don't. Yeah, I don't know.
I've heard that's true, but I've never experienced it.
We perfectionists don't like to admit that we have to learn anything. And so we actually do, but it takes time to learn. So, I mean, I see guitars behind you. And so I'm imagining the first time you picked up a guitar, you weren't like amazing at it. And you somehow got some feedback at that, like, do this or change this, or this is the right note to play, or try this, that'll make it easier. And you were open to the feedback. Many of our overcontrol clients won't even pick up a guitar because they're so afraid of the feedback that they will be given, and or they get the feedback and they shut down. And that's a really hard way to live. So we're teaching them that actually the learning process is a lifelong thing, and there's stages of it. And being an expert isn't the best thing. Sometimes it's nice to actually be a novice, which is cool. So that's kind of like this receptivity and openness, mental health area. The second part is this flexible control. So we're kind of talking about adapting to our environment, because the world is always changing. You know, think about the last, how everybody had to adapt and change to the pandemic. And some people really, really struggled with that. And they may lean over control, or maybe they weren't able to roll with the punches, so to speak, of what they needed to do in order to keep themselves safe. And so they might not know how to socially signal or get their needs met. And so flexible control is all about changing our behaviors or particularly our viewpoints in order to live a healthy life. And so what we do talk to them about is context-dependent appropriate social signaling, which basically means like, I'm not necessarily going to show up the same way with every person in my life because that doesn't really make sense. Like, I don't talk to my, you know, boss the same way I talk to my kid. That doesn't really make sense. And then the last part of this is this intimacy and connectedness, which we sort of touched on already, but you know, our species survival required capacities to form long-lasting social bonds and working groups or social communities. And the research really supports that we really just need one person at least with a really high level of intimacy to feel good, safe, supported. And as long as I connect on that very deep level, I'm going to have pretty good mental health. And a lot of our clients may have a lot of relationships, but they might not have a high level of intimacy. Sometimes my clients will say things like, nobody really knows me. And that's got to be a tough way to live. And so it's sort of sad. And it's also, I really feel for them because we're teaching them how to make friends, what genuine friendship is, how to chit chat, frankly, how to talk and connect with someone and not see everything as so serious all the time.
How much does a felt sense of defectiveness fuel some of the threat?
Ooh, this is an interesting question. So I wouldn't say that that's true for all of my over-controlled clients. I wouldn't say that everybody comes in saying that they're defective or something's wrong, but there are some that do. A lot of them might talk about it in terms of like feeling really insecure, not being good enough. And others might talk about it in terms of like, I just want to be really competent or see status or see that I'm really good at something. And that's sort of hard. It may talk about, generally speaking, the two types of over control for a second, and maybe that will help understand this. So there's something called overly agreeable and then overly disagreeable. And these are subtypes of over control. And if you have over control, you tend to lean one way or another. An overly agreeable person tends to be pro-social, meaning they really want to be liked. They're doing a lot of effort to connect with others, although it's very surface level. So they may have a ton of friends, but they may not be connecting on a very deep level, or they might do some kind of funky social signaling, like a lot of like smiling and not a lot of changes to their face. And they may talk in a high voice or something that's a little off, and you're kind of confused about why they're doing that. And it's because their threat system is on and they haven't actually relaxed into the social situation. And for them, they are trying to connect so much that they've sort of looked at the environment and said, oh, these are the kinds of social signals that help people connect, but they're over implementing them in some way. And a lot of times the problem with working with people that are overly agreeable is that because they're so pro-social, they're maybe not telling you exactly what's really going on for them underneath. So you really have to maybe take time to understand, are they with you in therapy, or are they kind of masking in this very pro-social way that makes you think that they're with you? And we take the stance of like, until you've had what we call an alliance rupture, where someone's kind of gotten into like some sort of disagreement or misunderstanding, you really can't say that you have a good therapeutic relationship with an overly agreeable person until that has happened, because you have to like work to rebuild and make sure that that person feels like you're listening to them. So that's one side. With an overly disagreeable, that might be a more flat affect. They're really telling you what they think. They're very polite a lot of times as well. And so it's not that always an overly disagreeable person is rude or mean or anything like that, but they're going to tell you what's up. And they probably are going to tell you that they don't think that you're correct a lot. And that's okay. We take that as a learning opportunity to connect with them. And I think it's a really cool thing to work with an overly disagreeable, because they might do these behaviors called pushbacks, which are sort of like this plausibly deniable, like barb or sarcasm or things like that that happen that look a little prickly. But when you really get down to it, a lot of times they can be giant teddy bears underneath all that stuff. And so once you get rid of some of the prickliness, you're really looking at them, and they're underneath there, they sort of know that things are, they're not really showing up in the world the way that they want to, and they want to connect and they want to actually be very loving a lot of times. And I kind of know with my overly disagreeables if they are joking with me back, or maybe they cry in session and you're kind of like, oh, this is a breakthrough. This is really cool. And you tend to have a lot of alliance ruptures with the disagreeables because they're really telling you what you think, which can be concerning. I don't know if you've had that experience. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say that what the second half of what you just described with the disagreeable clients, I mean, that's welcome to working with military and police officers.
Yes, yes, right? Yes. When I've worked with some of my vets, they may lean that way also. And I think it's pretty functional a lot of times in the military to have that shaped up. So you can kind of think like, well, when do I want to keep that side of myself? And when is it actually not working? Because, you know, going home and having an overly disagreeable attitude with my kid or my spouse, that's going to not really work very well.
Exactly. If it's a life or death situation, I think frankness and accurately speaking to what's going on is really adaptive. Mm-hmm. If it's like, hey, what do you want to have for dinner tonight? That's a different
set
of circumstances.
We're going to have this, you know, like maybe not time to control, right? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. For both agreeable and disagreeable clients, I'm going to take a real deep dive here and see where it goes. Do you find that these clients perhaps wake up at some point in their lives discovering that they are not in lives that are their own, that because of perhaps of the rigidity or the inability to be flexible with themselves and others, perhaps that their life gets sort of into a track and they're not able to deviate from that until maybe it's a critical mass of some kind?
You know, that's interesting. It makes me think of the clients that I've worked with, and there's quite a few of them that have achieved really high levels of status, maybe doctors, lawyers, professors, that then look back at their life and they're like, I'm not happy doing what I'm doing because I was and I think that's across agreeables and disagreeables. I've seen that on both sides, where they may be thinking that this is the right way to live. And then they kind of get into therapy and we're talking about why they're not happy. And it comes out that they don't even like the job. And some psychologists that I've had as clients say, like, you know, I really like learning about human behavior, but I don't really enjoy, you know, seeing clients on a daily basis. And I was like, okay, well, let's figure out what you want to do. Because it's never too late to change courses. And that's that flexible responding of like, we don't have to suffer for the rest of our lives. We can actually find something else to do that is more in line with who we want to be. And I think that for them, then there's a lot of self-forgiveness of, I should have known better. And I should have been able to see this sooner. And then they may beat themselves up. And so there's a big component of this therapy that works on forgiveness of self, forgiveness of not knowing everything about the world, because how could we? And in grief and loss of maybe the time spent being unhappy as well.
Well, I really appreciate that take. I mean, it makes me reflect on, you know, the work I've done with clients a lot more recently, where it's like, you can't take care of somebody who you don't know exists or you're not familiar with them. I mean, imagine like someone dropped off a kid on your front door and said, hey, you got to watch this kid for the week. You'd have the basics down, but you wouldn't have a lot of nuance ready to go in terms of what they need, what their favorites things are, what bedtime is, things like that. Mm-hmm. And I find when clients are not open to their internal experience, it's very difficult for them to properly take care of themselves because they actually don't know what they need. And then how that is supposed to manifest in the world in terms of a job or a spouse or choice of friendships, things like that. So I'm very intrigued by this idea of this rigidity almost also internally.
Yep.
In terms of like, I can't feel this, or I shouldn't feel that, or I shouldn't like this, or that desire is inappropriate. I think that really wraps people into a knot and they're not able to express themselves as they're supposed to in this world.
This may be a good area to touch on also the difference between, you know, traditional DBT and RO-DBT. Traditional DBT is working on mood-dependent behaviors and stopping those. And RO, a lot of times, we're working on rule-dependent behaviors. So I should show up like this. I should act like this. This is the way to live. And then people may be seeing that as closed-minded or inflexible. And in some ways, it might be. But it's not that every rule is the problem. So you know, there might be really great rules to continue in your life about maybe how to treat others or things like that. But then there's rules that they may have that they don't even know that they're operating from. And when we start to talk about these rules, they're like, oh my gosh, I just never even thought, like, you know, I got this from this one interaction I had with my parents this ago, and boy, do I not even care about that. I want to change it. And it gives them this freedom to look at the rule and think, is it functional for me anymore? Do I want to live like this? Or what do I need to change? And how does my social signaling show up in terms of this rule? Trying to think of an example of a rule-governed behavior. So maybe a good example would be always get straight A's. And that's what you should do. That's what a student should do. And then to really think about, does that make me happy? Do I care about school? Who gave me that rule? Is that how I want to live anymore? Or do I actually like to learn? Maybe I don't want to go to grad school or X, Y, or Z. And maybe I want to do something different that would be more in alignment with who I want to be as a person. And that's their choice, because we're not telling them how to live. We're actually asking them, really, who do they want to be? How do they want to show up?
I want to ramp up the complexity even just a little bit more around this in terms of how RODBT might deal with mixed feelings. You know, we're all multitudes. We might have a take on a person or a situation or a place or a thing that is not completely aligned with itself, right? We might have different takes on the same thing, and there might be, by way of metaphor, almost sub versions of ourselves that have different takes on things. Mm-hmm. How does RODBT speak to holding mixed feelings, making space for that, tolerating the dissonance that can come up just as a function of being a human being and being complex?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting thought. I think the idea of dialectics is helpful there, to think, you know, two things that seem like opposites can be true at the same time, and that there being space and room for that. And also kind of really examining this idea that it has to be one or the other, because a lot of our clients tend to be concrete or want to know how to act in every given situation. It doesn't allow for that flexible responding. So I think it goes back to this thought of, when do I want to be adaptable? And maybe there's a time to laugh and joke, and maybe there's a time to be serious. And so I don't know if that exactly answers the question, but I think that what we really are trying to have them reflect on is that when they get into a black or white world, it's actually not very fun to live there. It's much more fun to live in this flexible responding world, where you can look at a situation and be like, oh, I want to be this now. And then over here, it's really fun, because, you know, if I want to go to a party and dance wildly because it's like what everybody's doing, that's great. But then maybe I don't go to class and dance on my chair. It's maybe not appropriate. Yeah.
Well, I think that black and white take on the world doesn't map the complexity of the world appropriately. And if you're working off a bad map, then your coping is going to fall apart, right? So, yeah. Or it's certainly going to be impaired. So I guess what I try to do with my own clients, again, not particularly in this framework, but is to get them to see that it's only the truth, right? We're just trying to get a handle on the truth of the matter.
Yeah.
It's what exists already, whether we want to acknowledge that or not. And I know that for me, that's been a journey I've been on in terms of acknowledging my internal experience. And I empathize with clients. It's difficult to acknowledge what's going on in there sometimes.
Yeah, it really is. It is tough. It makes me think too about this idea that when our clients are not able to adjust, and they're bringing these perceptual and regulatory biases into social situations, and they think that there's one way to live, it really functions to isolate them. And frankly, a lot of my clients have been victims of bullying and things like that, because they are seen as different. And sometimes when they think and reflect on their lives, they know that something is not the same about who they are inherently. And I start talking to them about over control or these biological markers. And frankly, I've had, you know, people come into my office for the very first time. I talk about over control and they cry, because they're like, thank goodness somebody can tell me that this is a thing, and that there is a treatment for it. And so they actually start to really relax into it. And they're like, okay, I'm in, let's do this thing. And it brings tears to my eyes too, because when you see a client open up like that and they really recognize that they're identifying themselves as over control, and this has been the primary problem of why other things haven't worked, that actually opens the door to them getting better quickly, or well, relatively quickly, I guess, if they've been struggling a while. Mm-hmm.
Hope, what are some things that clinicians can look for in session to make sure they're not missing these clients for exactly the reason that you just described, right? Where, especially like maybe a really agreeable client where it's like, okay, I think everything's going okay here. They're, you know, things are going well. They, you know, we're getting along fine, but maybe not being aware of the true depth of the lake of tears that is below the surface in that particular client. So what should we be on the lookout for so that we don't miss these folks?
Well, I think it starts with a couple of things. At least with RO, what we're doing is after they've identified that they're over control, we're working on values and goals. Like, what is it that needs to change so that they no longer have mental health issues? And sometimes we're working at the personality level because we are working with a lot of personality disorders. But, you know, a client might come in and have never dated before. And what they want is to have a long-term committed romantic relationship. So we write that out, and then we start talking about how their social signaling is affected by, or what needs to change about their social signaling to get that goal met. And a lot of times our clients are experts at not appearing out of control. So what I'm looking at a lot of times is the discrepancy about how they're coming to therapy, but they're saying everything is fine. I'm like, well, why are you here? If everything's okay all the time, what are you doing in my office? And that's kind of the joke. And I kind of say it just like I just said it. And they kind of go, you got me. You know, they're not on their case. They sort of know they've been found out. And then we work to really think about, you know, is it important to look competent or to look like everything's okay all the time? And what would it be like for me to see the real you? And then they're kind of like, oh, geez. You know? But I think when you start to talk about how they mask with them, or when something's just really not lining up, that's what to target. And I hope that that kind of answers it. With, and a lot of times the agreeables may be doing more of the everything's fine, and a disagreeable may be telling you more what's happening for them, but also still wanting to do a very good job too. And so with maybe a disagreeable, I'm really emphasizing things like, hey, it's okay to not get it right the first time, and keep trying and keep dating and keep doing this thing. And, you know, make, you know, understand that not everybody is born as an expert relationship maker. You know, these are skills that we have to learn. Yeah.
Hope, is it okay if we spend a few minutes talking about obsessive compulsive personality disorder?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Excellent. Because that's a presentation that, you know, when a clinician sees that on the referral, it may lead to some anxiety and distress, just given how folks, you know, living with obsessive compulsive personality disorder can sometimes present. So OCPD from the RODBT lens. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's the quintessential disorder of overcontrol. Rigid rule-governed behavior, inflexible responding, lack of social connection. Those are the things that happen with this disorder. And what I think is interesting is it's also very underdiagnosed and misdiagnosed. I get a lot of people that have come in with like a narcissism diagnostic that are actually not narcissistic. We know, you know, that actually narcissism is a very low number, and OCPD, it's at least in the United States, is 1 in 12 people about. That's a lot of people that have that. So about 2 to 8% of the population is walking around with OCPD. And it's very functional because there's a lot of maybe CEOs, doctors, lawyers, surgeons, professors, psychologists. I mean, like a lot of people that are in high powered positions are maybe have this disorder because it's helped them achieve what they what's going on, but they might feel really lonely or sad on the inside. And so I think it's helpful to remind ourselves that a personality disorder is, or a personality is really just a set pattern of repeating behaviors that stays consistent over a period of time. And the disordered part of the personality happens when it starts to interfere with a person's social, family, or work life. So when I get a referral for someone that has OCPD, or frankly, at this point, since that's like one of my specialty areas, I get a lot of people that are saying, I have OCPD, please, can I come see you? I'm like, sure, come on in. And we talk about what theirs looks like, because not everybody everybody's OCPD looks the same. You know, we're looking at orderliness, perfectionism, control, you know, troubles with task delegation, task completion, trouble with developing close relationships, both friends and romantic. Sometimes they have miserly spending styles, this thing called moral certitude, I'm right, you're wrong. And this constant striving for productivity, which actually burns them out, and they can't relax and they can't have fun. And they have trouble also with learning and end up having some mental health issues because they can't chill out. So we do an assessment like we would do for everybody else. And then we'd start to understand how their social signaling interferes with getting healthy and getting close relationships. And so for someone that is got OCPD, they're very concerned with doing a good job. And it's, if you think about everything that we've talked about around perfectionism or status or being seen as competent, it's just right in there with what over control is. And because they're also threat sensitive, then they're seeing like problems everywhere and they can't turn their brain off to actually calm down and relax and take even a vacation because they're workaholics too. And so what I'm looking for is this, you know, pervasive pattern of rigidity in their life. And when it shows up in my office, most of them kind of know something is going on that's not exactly like the average bear, so to speak. And they kind of come in and they're like, yeah, let's work on this thing. I was also going to say the one thing that's a little different about OCPD or to look for as well is that sometimes they can be hyper-competitive and aggressive. So like games, sports, job, I have worked with NFL players, you know, surgeons, frankly, gambling addicts, things like that you wouldn't normally consider as like over control, but because they are planning these activities out or they strive, like think about a professional athlete, they are working really hard at their body and their craft and they're reward system turns on when they achieve something, but then just as quickly it turns off and they go on to the next achievement that they want. And so it's not, the presentation at the low reward sensitivity looks a little bit different sometimes than OCPD.
Is it ever the case, Hope, that someone with OCPD can learn to develop a very agreeable veneer that maybe is able to sort of pro-socially allow them to navigate the world, but betrays the rigidity, the competitiveness that is underneath the surface?
Yeah, you know, we see agreeables and disagreeables in OCPD. They tend to be more disagreeable overall, but with some of the agreeableness that shows up with OCPD, it tends to, they say yes to a lot of things. Yes, 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 yes. I'll do this, I'll do that, I'll do that. And it burns them out and then they get resentful. Why is everybody always asking me to do everything? How dare they? Don't they understand how hard I'm working? And that would be like a presentation and agreeableness, but they're actually not telling anybody that. And they're also not saying no or setting any kind of like, hey, I need to take some time off here. And so agreeable gets themselves into trouble in that way with OCPD. Disagreeables tend to like blow things up and have outbursts at work or what we call an emotional leak where they're holding it in, holding it in, holding it in, and they're like, boom. And that might be looking like anger or things like that. And like, you know, if you do that one more time, you know, kind of a thing. And I'm laughing at it, not because it's funny, but because it's kind of like, I don't know, you know, everybody breaks. Like we were talking about military, you know, I don't know about you, but everybody has their limits. Even like some of the special ops guys that I've worked with, you know, I've had one of them say to me things like, I can withstand 10 minutes of anything. And I'm like, I'm sure you can, but after 11 minutes, you're going to break too, because everybody can't be regulated and functioning all the time.
Yeah. I think a common phrase that I end up uttering to clients of that first responder ilk is just because you can do it doesn't mean that you should be doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. Right? Absolutely. I love that idea. I might steal that from you.
Please. You don't mind. And I probably stole it from somebody else. So please go ahead.
Yeah.
Go right ahead. Hope, in discussing the outline for this podcast, we were talking a little bit about how traditional therapies might let down or not be able to benefit clients with over-control or OCPD, things like that. Can you maybe speak to that piece just a little bit more? I think that's really fascinating.
Yeah, the biotemperament and that threat sensitivity, I think, is incredibly important to remember, because biotemperament is operating this genetic sensory level. It's happening preconsciously. And this is a critical point. So it means that our over-control clients can't talk or think their way out of their biology. And so, like, think about something like CBT, which is a great therapy for more flexible or optimal control people. And I think it works really well for that. But if you're really over-controlled, you can't change your thinking because your biology is interfering with you being able to get there. You know, if you and I may lean moderately one way or another, maybe we both lean over control, we might still retain our ability to respond flexibly. But a over-controlled client with a extreme biotemperament can't adjust flexibly. They're inadvertently bringing all of these perceptual and regulatory biases with them. And then, so if you think about it in terms of like what's going on in the brain, our sensory receptors are, you know, I call like our spidey sense, comes on at about 4 to 7 milliseconds. And language doesn't come on for another 200 milliseconds, which may not sound like that long, but in terms of biology and what we're talking about with over control, that's a big difference. And then around 500 milliseconds is that ability to reappraise a situation. So with high threat sensitivity, your threat is going on at 4, and then your reappraisal is not happening for about 500 or so. So you can't think your way out of something with that giant threat response that turns on for our threat sensitive people. And so their body's responding as if it's fight or flight. And what we have to do is teach them to turn on their social safety system, which is body based. So we're teaching them things that help them to relax into a social situation so they don't respond rigidly. And this is the different approach in particular. We've got to get their social safety system on so that they can start making connections. And it's a very integrative approach. So we look at things like stop talking about the emotions and thoughts and start looking at how your body is responding, and then think about how you want to signal in any given situation. So we might use things like breath, loving kindness meditations, social safety activation toolkits, you know, something like as simple as raising and lowering my eyebrows and making sure my face is moving can actually help someone's physiological relaxation response. A lot of my clients breathe in their chest and they're never actually getting their innervated stomach muscles going. So we actually teach them to change where they're breathing. How fast they're breathing, we actually slow it down. We're doing a lot of things that help them go into a social situation. Like say a date, they've never dated for the first time or they're afraid of making friends, we might do some social safety activation, prep them, and then get them engaging socially so that they can do it. To be honest, what happened before I actually got on this call with you was I did a loving kindness meditation. And it's specifically designed to turn on my social safety system so that I can present myself in a social way that I'd like to. And if you'd like to find out what that is, you're welcome to get that on my website. I'm sure we can figure that out. But it turns on anywhere from 20 minutes to 4 hours of social safety activation, because it's working not at a traditional level where there's like 5 parts to loving kindness. We're really only working with people that we already know and like, and then strangers, and then it can kind of like really help us to show up in a very pro-social way.
Well, it's really fascinating. And yes, absolutely. We'll put any links that you would like in the show notes for sure. For a client who's interested in RODBT, what can they expect in terms of format? Is it individual, some combination of individual and group? Are there coaching calls? I'm just drawing from my knowledge of DBT here in terms of perhaps what it could look like.
it's sort of similar. So we have one individual session and one skills class weekly, and we call it skills class because it's not like a process group. It's like, learn a skill, do your homework, come back, let's talk about it. And that actually, we kind of talk about it in terms of like, it's kind of more like school, which a lot of our perfectionists like anyway. So they tend to really like groups, and sometimes they, or skills classes rather, and they do it and they learn these skills, and then the application part happens during the week. And in the individual sessions, what we're talking about is their social signaling and how their value goals are being impeded by some of the maladaptive social signaling that's happening. With coaching calls, they tend to rarely happen. I don't get called a ton because my clients say things like, well, I didn't want to bother you, or this can wait till next time, or it's not that big of a deal. And they might minimize it. And so if I can actually get a client to call me, I'm actually working with a client right now to try and get her to reach out to me outside of sessions, because we need other people. I was like, let me help you. And she has trouble actually accepting or asking for help. So that is something that we want to do, is allow our clients to reach out and build relationships that way. The only time that we ever get a ton of phone calls is if someone has been like maybe trained up to do that. And then we actually work on training them down. You know, maybe you don't need it as much as you're taking advantage of, but that's so rare. Most of our clients are really more of the, you know, I don't want to bother you. No, I can take care of myself. I can do this stuff. And so if they do happen, we're actually like, sure, great. It's okay.
Hope, one last question for you. I run a therapy group every week, and one of the things I like to do at the end is ask clients to maybe reflect on one little thought experiment throughout the week. For instance, like I want you to notice every time that you're unwilling to experience an emotion of some kind, and then not do anything differently about it, but just to notice it. For any clinicians that are listening or mental health consumers, is there anything that people can do to maybe build awareness around over control within themselves that maybe is like a simple thing they could do throughout the week?
You know, I think that actually, if you don't mind me saying two things.
Of course.
The first one is to start thinking about this idea of the mind-body connection. Is the threat system that we're talking about emotionally is anxiety or irritation. So when one of those two things turn on, you can kind of go, oh, I'm in my threat system. And reflect, is this a time where I want to be in my threat system? And if not, then maybe I slow my breath. I relax. I sit back in my chair. I take a sip of water. I do something that activates my relaxation or calm system. And I think that that alone, noticing how often and like maybe someone that leans over control is in their threat system, and then moving back to the other one, starting to choose to switch it when they want to, that can be really helpful. And then to also think about, this is kind of a harder one because sometimes we're not exactly sure what our behavior is, but if we're thinking about social signaling, and in particular, all a social signal is any action, regardless of form, intent, or conscious awareness that occurs in the presence of another person. So I have to be in the presence of someone else. It can't be a text. It can't be an email. So how am I showing up in front of someone? To reflect on, is any of my social signaling getting in the way of connection? And have I ever gotten any feedback about a particular social signal, maybe a flat face or a monotonic voice or overly smiling or smiling when you're distressed or anything, or walking away in the middle of an argument? Is there any social signal that you think that maybe interferes with the relationship? And you can kind of start to notice, like, what have you gotten feedback about? Or what do you think you would like to work on changing? And if we do that, then it tends to actually help people start to know what to target, which is a really cool thing. Yeah.
Well, that's wonderful. That's really, really helpful. And again, I think my mission here is to promote a sense of you can't take care of somebody who you don't know or you don't know exists. So I think building that awareness is the first step. Mm-hmm. Hope, if people are interested in RODBT, interested in learning more about the work that you do, where can they find you?
Sure. So there's a lot of resources, the international website, and trainings that not only I do, but also other senior clinicians do, is on www.radicallyopen.net. And that has a ton of resources, including links to buy skills manuals or textbooks or things like that. Also, my website is rodbtdenver.com. It has a lot of resources and things like that loving kindness meditation that you can download for free. Also, there is now an app out that I developed with my friend and RODBT therapist, Lori Prado, and it's just called the RODBT app. And it's on Apple or the
Apple. The App Store, I believe.
Yeah. You can buy it on Apple downloads. And then the we're writing right now a RODBT OCPD workbook should come out next year. And that will be wonderful. And there's a eating disorder workbook also coming out. Hopefully, I think in the next couple of months as well, if people are interested in that.
Well, wonderful. I'd love to have you back to talk about the workbook for sure. I think that would be really interesting.
Wonderful. I'd love to come back.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much, Hope. I've learned so much today. In fact, I want to dig really deep on this. It's just really piqued my interest. So thanks so much for coming today. I've really appreciated it.
I enjoyed it myself. Thanks so much, Pete.
Okay, take good care.
Well, I really hope that you enjoyed the podcast as much as I did. If you found value in the show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. And now for the mandatory disclaimer. This podcast represents the opinions of Dr. Kelly and that of his guests. Content of the podcast should not be taken as psychological advice and is for general information only. Please consult your mental health professional for any specific questions around your psychological health. In no way does listening to our content establish a psychologist-client relationship. While we make every effort to ensure that the information we are sharing is accurate, we welcome any comments, suggestions, or corrections of errors. All people, places, and scenarios mentioned in the podcast have been changed to protect patient confidentiality. Finally, this podcast should not be used in any legal capacity whatsoever, including but not limited to establishing a standard of care in a legal sense or as a basis for expert witness testimony. No guarantee is given regarding the accuracy of any statements or opinions made on the podcast.